This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today, a panel discussion on the foreign policy of the Biden administration during unprecedented times. Even as the U.S. approaches a fully vaccinated population, India, Brazil, and many African countries are experiencing the worst COVID-19 caseloads of the pandemic. Vaccine patent waivers have become a top global issue as developing countries ask to manufacture and distribute privately owned vaccines themselves. The Biden administration has signaled it will not stand in the way of such waivers, but the negotiations are still slow going at the World Trade Organization. Another visible aspect of U.S. foreign policy is in the Middle East, recently highlighted by the ceasefire between Israel and Palestine that was backed by the Biden presidency. The escalating attacks between Palestinians and Israeli forces also comes as President Joe Biden approved a $735 million arms deal with Israel. This week's panel looks at how these foreign policies compare to historical precedent and how foreign relations will change during the uncertain and tumultuous times the world finds itself. This week's panelists include Jeffrey Miser, Associate Professor in the University of Portland's Political Science Department, Lauren Turek, Assistant Professor in Trinity University's History Department, and Brent Steele, Professor and Chair of the University of Utah's Political Science Department. The Hinckley Institute's Ann Lopez will be moderating this week's discussion. This forum was put on in partnership with the University of Utah's Political Science Department. This forum was recorded on November 18, 2020. Here's your first panelist, Jeffrey Miser.
It's a great pleasure to talk about something other than Minecraft for a while. I'm an eight-year-old, and you cannot imagine the amount of number of ideas about Minecraft I've heard and I hear like per hour with my son, which I thoroughly enjoy, but this is also going to be nice. So the topic is U.S. foreign policy during uncertain times, and I'm going to spend my time here talking about three main questions. One is, what will Biden do as president? What is missing from the things that he's going to do? And then what should he do? So I think the obvious set of things he'll do is reversing a bunch of Trump policies that he finds to be not in the interest of the United States. And a lot of experts agree with this list of things. Obviously, we start with coronavirus, which isn't specifically a foreign policy issue, but that can consume a bunch of time for the Biden presidency. And I think that makes sense because Democrats view the coronavirus as the biggest threat to the United States. Independents agree. So that's his basic constituency, and he'll follow through on a number of measures there to ramp up federal action on dealing with the coronavirus. Also then working with distributing vaccines and those kind of things. But the world is not waiting for that. The world is happening all around us. There are things happening every day internationally. And it seems that President Trump right now is kind of on hiatus. So more and more will be happening and the U.S. will not be responding very nimbly to those things as they're going on. So so Biden will have to take actions with foreign policy, obviously. So The list of things to do almost on day one are things like rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement, rejoin the WHO, which Trump has started the process of pulling out of. And those are sort of the basic kind of things to do on day one. And also along with that, there'll be big rhetorical changes. And they're starting even right now as well. So Biden will speak much differently about our allies and embrace them much more warmly. You'll put more distance between the U.S. and authoritarian powers like Russia, China, North Korea. There'll be a big change in rhetoric there. They'll be matched by an increase in talking about human rights. And Biden will say a lot more about human rights and be challenging those authoritarian countries on their human rights record. You'll also be more engaging and hospitable to smaller countries around the world. He will not demean them in the way that Trump apparently has been demeaning them. So all across the board, the rhetoric will change pretty significantly. So that's kind of very short-term stuff. In the medium term, then I think Biden will move forward on new international multilateral engagement efforts. A new Iran deal, for example, that Trump pulled out of, that the Obama administration worked hard to push through. Also, arms control. Be more focused on arms control with Russia and moving those initiatives forward. So definitely investing more in allies, in multilateralism, in international institutions and organizations. Those will all be big efforts by the Biden administration. What's missing from that? What's missing is any discussion of great power politics. What will Biden administration do about China, which is the number one issue for Republicans? The number one thing that Republicans are worried about is the rise of China. And secondly, international terrorism. So those are issues, big issues for the United States. And then the intransigent Russia. Russia is not a rising power, but it's continuing to cause problems from the US perspective around the world. So what should be done about that? So now I'm just gonna shift into what should we do? What should Biden do? And I'm just gonna be very humble here and propose a national strategy for the United States. And the strategy, as I'm gonna call it, is entanglement. And this comes from George Washington's farewell address. Some of you will know this. He counseled against entanglement. So I'm gonna say the opposite of what George Washington said to do a couple hundred years ago and say, let's get very entangled here. And what I mean by that is really with our allies. And this is not an issue of, well, let's just kind of reinvigorate our alliances, go back to the Obama era perspective on alliances and multilateralism. It's feeling we have to go deeper than that. And we have to actually invest deeply in these alliances. And this number one is in Europe and especially with NATO allies, and essentially move to a situation where we're giving NATO and our top allies essentially a veto power on major US foreign policy decisions. That is not engaging them and saying, hey, we're here. If you want to step up and do the things that we want to do, do it. Like, that's what you should do. And instead of having that perspective, instead say, hey, what do you think we should do? You know, have that kind of conversation with our allies and move it forward in that direction. So deep engagement with our allies, this is framed as a strategy here, is if we do that, I believe that will cause us to have greater capacity to solve problems. And this definitely is, as the title of this roundtable suggests, really is a time of uncertainty. And it's difficult to create a strategy in a time of uncertainty. The way I define strategy is it's a theory of success. A theory is a causal statement. So you have to say, we're gonna do this set of actions and we're gonna cause this result to happen. And right now, I don't know that the US has that vision of what success looks like for the United States, because some say, hey, we need to balance against China. We need to contain China. I don't think we're there yet. I think there's some uncertainty there about what is necessarily gonna have to happen with China. But I do know that building up capacity to deal with a possible great power challenger in China is a good idea. And I think that we can use the same strategy to move forward potentially with things like climate change, global health. If we increase our capacity and we increase capacity to work with others, then that will set us up to solve a full range of challenges that are definitely going to be things we have to deal with. So, and some people call it grand strategy. I like to say national strategy. Strategy for the United States, I'm proposing, should be entanglement, that is deep engagement and coordination with our allies in Europe. When we move to East Asia, it has to be primarily solving the Japanese problem. The Japanese problem, like the so-called German problem of post-World War II, is the fact that other countries in East Asia, they don't necessarily trust Japan that much. There's a lot of bad feelings left over from the atrocities committed by Japan during World War II. And at least the perspective or the point of view of other countries in East Asia, that Japan has not given a real apology for those things that they've done. And so one major line of effort for the United States in their diplomacy is to make that right, is to get those countries to engage more deeply. And the first priority is the South Korean-Japanese relationship, strengthening that. And I think moving towards a NATO-style kind of alliance system in East Asia. So with that, I think I'll conclude my statement here, and I look forward to hearing from my colleagues.
Professor Turek, if you'd like to go next. Great, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really delighted to be part of today's conversation. I'd like to focus in on some of the issues that Dr. Meiser raised. I want to focus in particular on US human rights policies in this moment of uncertainty and to think about the ways in which human rights policies and other similar US foreign policies project certain values and moral stances globally. Of course, I'm going to be approaching it from a historical lens, but I want to start in our present moment. We're in this moment of transition with this election over and President-elect Biden preparing now for his inauguration in January. But we need to remember that the political dynamics that brought us to the Trump presidency are not going to disappear on January 20th. They will endure for some time to come. My research focuses on the role of evangelical Christians in shaping US foreign policy during the late Cold War. And we know that white evangelical Christians made up a very important and loyal part of Trump's base. And while their share of the US population is declining proportionally as compared to other religious groups, they have long exercised a tremendous and indeed outsized influence on US politics, again, far beyond their relative population. We often think of evangelicals in the United States as having their largest influence on domestic politics, hot button issues like abortion and the like. But we should remember that that influence also extends to US foreign policy and not just to relations with Israel, although that's what we often think about. One of the core ideas that I explore in my research is the ways in which evangelicals have mobilized around the issue of international religious freedom, particularly their right to evangelize, and have in focusing on that actually helped to create a politically conservative Christian vision for US human rights policy that has had an incredibly important influence on conservative politicians. And Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is a very good example of how that vision has actually been articulated in the very recent past, literally this year, to the world. Back in July of 2019, he launched a new State Department commission, a commission on unalienable rights, which was charged with defining a human rights policy and reviewing the role of human rights in U.S. foreign relations. And there has been a number of articles that came out that have reported on this work, and he has given speeches where he has asserted that it should be the goal of the United States to prioritize religious freedom above all other potential rights, that he is concerned that human rights discourse is too broad and unfocused, that groups that he does not agree with politically have, quote, hijacked those discussions and discourses around rights, and therefore he wants to narrow the focus. Earlier this year, in July of 2020, his commission released a draft report which asserted, among other things, and I'm quoting from the report right now, foremost among the unalienable rights that government is established to secure from the founders' point of view are property rights and religious liberty. So again, he reiterated over and again that the United States should be prioritizing religious liberty above other rights, right? So the fact that he is emphasizing this particular posture for the United States foreign policy is very consequential. It is diminishing protections for other types of human rights and making a particular announcement about the United States' priorities abroad. And that set of priorities sends a signal to leaders all over the world about what the United States might or might not tolerate in terms of how they treat their citizens. So again, very consequential. Now, a lot of the news coverage seemed to treat this report and Pompeo's speeches about it as something of a new articulation of US human rights policy, but it's actually not new. It is very much in line with the types of human rights policies that white evangelical Christians in the United States have been advocating for since the late 1970s. My book, which came out earlier this year, actually looks at the emergence of evangelical foreign policy lobbyists who were focused very specifically on promoting religious liberty or religious freedom as a core tenet of US foreign policy starting in the late 1970s. And I devote a lot of time in the book to explaining how that came about. Evangelicals had, of course, long been concerned about religious persecution in communist countries, especially in the Soviet Union. But starting in the 1970s, there was a confluence of factors that led to the development of a new body of foreign policy lobbying, or their new power as a lobbying force. They were very concerned in the 1970s that there were so many people who had not yet heard the gospel. And so as they launched initiatives to try to expand their missionary reach, to reach what they saw as 2 billion people who had been unreached, using radio and other and some clandestine methods, they came into greater contact with Christians throughout the world who were suffering from persecution. In gaining access and information about that persecution, they wanted to advocate for their co-religionists. They also saw that there was lobbying happening in Congress on behalf of other persecuted religious groups like Jews in the Soviet Union. And noting that their lobbying efforts were effective, evangelicals said, well, we should be lobbying on these issues too. And they began to lobby, particularly around religious freedom in the Soviet Union. And by the 1980s, they had proved fairly effective at that. And in testifying on behalf of persecuted Christians abroad, they managed to articulate a pretty cohesive conservative vision for a human rights policy that placed religious liberty at the forefront of their goals. And by the time Reagan came into office in the early 80s, that was a very useful perspective on human rights. And they actually went and testified to support his nominations for the, you know, secretaries that would be in charge of human rights and humanitarian affairs in the State Department. But at the core of that, they really placed their idea that their freedom to evangelize, their freedom for people to hear their gospel, that was the most vital human right that they envisioned, that they saw that as the core right. And nothing else, no other abuse could possibly compare to the potential loss for ultimate salvation that hearing the gospel might provide. And so they really prioritize religious freedom above all else. They elevate that. Now, the flip side of that is that this perspective also led many evangelicals to see authoritarian or expressly anti-totalitarian regimes as friendly to their objectives, which enabled them to interpret brutal repression and state violence in authoritarian countries as not just acceptable, but sometimes desirable as an effort to combat both communism and religious repression. But they framed those conflicts using human rights language. And by adopting human rights language in support of broader conservative foreign policy goals, they actually helped to define this conservative human rights vision that we see in Mike Pompeo's statement. So there is this line that we can see coming from the late 70s and 80s of this particular vision. So we're living with this very much today. So I would say that this is a particular issue that we're going to have to think about going forward. What is the human rights stance that the United States should be projecting? Do we want it to be an incredibly narrow focus on just certain rights for certain people? Or do we want our leaders to be projecting a broad set of protections for not just this one core fundamental value of the United States, religious liberty, but all of the range of values that the United States has in its constitution, the values that it aspires to and has not yet fully met? Do we want to have a human rights policy that is broader and more representative of those large values? So I think going forward, that's something that we'll want to think about, is who do we put into positions of power in the State Department going forward? And what sort of values should we be projecting through our U.S. foreign policy?
Thank you, Professor Turek. That was wonderful. Professor Steele, you're up.
All right. Thanks so much. Thanks to the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and thanks so much to my fellow panelists for already getting us going in a very productive direction. So my, I guess, focus is titled Four Lessons for U.S. Foreign Policy, with a focus on status during times of uncertainty like we're dealing with right now. So the first lesson is that, and this is just an assumption I'm making, this is an observation that I would issue, is that U.S. foreign policy, looking back, has been animated and driven by the identity need of maintaining status. Now, sometimes this is overlapped with a concern as well for the well-being of the American people, but over the past 20 years, maybe going back even further than that, the concern with the well-being of the American people has been de-emphasized, sometimes in favor of maintaining the U.S.'s hegemonic status in global politics. Sometimes even that focus on status has come at the expense of the well-being of the American people. So that's the first lesson. Second lesson related, as a result, the use of U.S. military power, the deployment of force, has not always been a means to an end regarding the U.S. national interest, but it's become an end itself. U.S. military power has been deployed not necessarily as a deterrent, but rather as a way to maintain the U.S.'s status and the views of that use of power by Americans themselves. Thus, the use of force may be justified rhetorically as in the U.S. national interest, but it's really about inflicting pain or punishment against others, because that's what powerful countries must do. Further, it's an end itself because deploying force, violent force, to some degree feels good. This is perhaps, as it should be, a feature not of the U.S. now, but of human nature always. And so if we read Reinhold Niebuhr's magnum opus, Moral Man and Moral Society, he famously asserted at one point, and I'm using his vernacular here, this needs to be updated a little bit regarding genderizing it a little bit. But he says, and I quote, "The man in the street with his lust for power and prestige thwarted by his own limitations and the necessities of social life projects his ego upon his nation and indulges his anarchic lusts vicariously. So the nation is a final vent for the expression of individual egoism." So construed then, the benefit of U.S. military power and its violent deployment is that it feels good to inflict pain, especially on others who either do not recognize the U.S.'s superior status or have wronged the U.S. in the past. So the strike against Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, which actually happened at the beginning of this year, it feels like it was a decade ago, but that was in 2020. The strike against that Iranian general at the beginning of 2020 didn't necessarily make the U.S. and its soldiers safer. In fact, it led to a counterstrike by Iran on an airbase in Iraq a few days later that injured over 100 U.S. soldiers. But the strike on Soleimani felt good, because he had done the U.S. and its interests wrong in the past, and his regime had a long and particularly sharp series of engagements with the U.S. going back all the way to the 1970s and the Iranian Revolution. And thus, the U.S. use of force was a way to right some past wrongs, to exact revenge, and it felt good. So third, this way of looking at U.S. foreign policy and what shapes U.S. drives within it sheds light on otherwise puzzling possibilities regarding COVID, and why there doesn't seem to be the urgency or collective effort to get the pandemic under control as there has been in other countries dealing with the COVID pandemic in their borders. This way of looking at U.S. foreign policy and what shapes it may also explain the fixation in some circles of the U.S. to blame the pandemic here on the way it was handled in other countries, especially China. Because if you can make the U.S. look better than another rising power, Dr. Meiser mentioned the fixation on China, and with good reason regarding rising powers. But if you can blame the pandemic on China and make the U.S. look a little bit better than it, or at least tell yourself that we are not as bad as them, then that's all there is to it. Here, what animates U.S. governance is not per se the well-being of the American people. Rather, it's strengthening a group's status and solidifying a view of the U.S. itself. In this context, the withdrawal from the aforementioned Iran nuclear deal, as the Trump administration did just a couple of years ago, isn't necessarily something intended to protect the American people. For as we know from the news just last week, Iran has never been closer than it is today to getting a nuclear weapon. But the withdrawal from that deal was necessary to maintain U.S. status. Being in a deal, any deal, including the aforementioned Paris Climate Accord, conversely puts the U.S. on a somewhat equal footing with another international actor, adversaries especially included. So a country obsessed with status rather than national security just can't have a deal. But fourth, yet one tragic or ironic likelihood is that those who obsess over the status of the United States rather than, or at least equally, about the well-being of the American people have impacted the status of the United States anyway by not prioritizing the well-being of the American people, whether that is in slowing the pandemic down or responding to the systemic inequalities of the U.S. economic or justice systems, or simply in the broader instability and crisis of confidence that currently defines the United States. There's no doubt that the United States maintains the supreme ability to project its military strength anywhere in the world. And I think that we probably all agree that that's not going anywhere. And it can do so in many areas without immediate consequence or retaliation from a would-be adversary. But status is not only about self-esteem, it's about recognition. Status has to be maintained and earned within a community. It's not something that you can just issue by fiat. It is rather relational. Many of us study international relations, and so we focus on the relational effects and impacts of some of these things. So how might allies view a would-be hegemonic country in terms of its power, here understood outside of just the military context, when it's the richest and most advanced country in the world, and yet it is, as of this morning, somewhere between 8th and 12th in the world in terms of deaths per capita due to COVID? How might allies view our would-be hegemonic country when we justify, or perhaps cavalierly dismiss, such death and destruction because of the demographics of who is dying? It's just the old. It's just people with pre-existing conditions and so on. How might adversaries view such a country in terms of its ability not only to protect, but maintain its power in such a light? How might adversaries view a country if that country can't or won't confront an existential threat to its own citizens, who are now dying at a rate of a 9/11 every 2 days? The U.S. still maintains features that it can marshal to continue to develop and even extend its power, its geography, its institutions of higher learning, which many of us are employed within, its ingenuity, its medical centers, its scientific expertise, and of course, its military and economic power. But what this all portends for the future is that to gain the actual status that the U.S. seeks, it has to do more than just zap bad guys on occasion with that supreme military power. Rather, it will need to lead, or at least collaborate on issues that the world, and here I'm echoing what my fellow panelists have already mentioned, issues that the world and many in the U.S. for that matter find to be of paramount importance, like climate change and global pandemics. And so the U.S. will need to highlight its intellectual, technological, and scientific resources and power and bring them to bear on those issues. Thank you.
That was Brent Steele, professor and chair of the University of Utah's Political Science Department. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. On this program, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. Today we are airing a panel discussion on U.S. foreign policy in uncertain times. Here is your moderator, Ann Lopez.
Thank you. That was wonderful. Okay, so we do have some questions, and I think the variety of questions we have, I have some specifically for each person and then some about some current events that are going on right now. So we'll start with the ones that are specific and then get into current events. The first one I have is for Professor Meiser. You mentioned that we need to deeply engage with our allies abroad. Do you think that given the uncertain relationships created during the Trump administration, will it be more difficult to do so looking forward? And what strategies would you suggest to heal these relationships?
Great question, thank you. I think that the way that the historical U.S. allies view the situation in the United States is that Trump was a bit of an aberration. And so with Biden coming in as president, it will be like Obama part two to some extent. And so I think that the U.S. would have more significant problems if Trump was reelected. Then I think people around the world would say, oh, I guess that's the country, how the country is now. But since he lost, I think people will have the sense of, well, it's back to how it was under Obama. And so I don't think there'll be that much difficulty in re-engaging. The difficulty will be in what the other branch of government look like, especially the Senate. If there's a Democratic Senate or Republican Senate, that can put some going to hamper Biden's foreign policy maybe to some extent, but presidents have a lot of power there, and I think he'll be able to kind of move forward. He's a known quantity to a lot of our allies, so I don't really see any big barriers for him moving forward.
You brought up a good point. Do you think that Biden will be like Obama? I think we all have this sort of idea that he will be, but do you think he really, really will be?
Well, I think he had a certain amount of influence on Obama's foreign policy, so I don't really see huge divergence from that. He'll be like Obama plus whatever else Obama or whatever else Biden wants to do, but I don't see a huge difference. I think there should be a difference, as I suggested, in terms of really deepening those alliance relationships more so than what was there under Obama. That's the big change I would like to see, and also engaging really deeply in East Asian diplomacy. But I don't see that Biden's really telegraphing anything major that will be different.
Do you see anything that might be a little bit unique with Harris being on the ticket, becoming our next vice president?
Yeah, I don't, in terms of foreign policy, I don't know. I think maybe her vision is a little bit more progressive in the sense of maybe doing more on the human rights issues, maybe doing more about inequality in the US and working trade agreements and economic relationships that will foster greater equality for the US. Those are seem to be kind of the larger, like progressive foreign policy goals. So I think she might kind of be pushing in that direction a bit, but you know, the power of a vice president varies quite a bit. And so we don't know exactly how that's going to work out right away. We'll have to kind of wait and see.
Also, if anyone else, any of you other panelists want to like chime in, you totally can, no worries. My next question is for Professor Turek. We had some questions from the audience about Israel-Palestine, because you talk so much about religious freedom. I thought these would be great questions for you. First, I want to just sort of go deeper into the fact that you mentioned that evangelicals prioritize the ability to share their message. And would you say that they prioritize this over freedom of religion itself, or are they sort of the same thing?
So they historically seem to see them as essentially being the same thing, right? Because for evangelicals, based on their particular set of beliefs, spreading the gospel is a core part of their religious identity and practice. So not being able to share their faith is a restriction on their ability to practice their religion. So they often conflate those as being the same. And one of the things that I note in that they were very active in promoting in terms of US foreign relations in the 70s and 80s was making sure that other countries, regardless of those countries' laws, right, particularly with the Soviet Union, would allow people in those countries to share their own faith, right? So that evangelicals in the Soviet Union could evangelize their countrymen without restriction. And that was something that was of a particular interest to the groups that I study. So they really do tend to conflate those and see them as exactly the same, just because of their core religious beliefs, that is a central aspect of being an evangelical, is not just having a born again experience or living your life sort of informed by the Bible, but sharing the word.
Okay, so I think with that in mind, can you comment a little bit on how they balance those views with the conflict in Israel-Palestine?
Yeah, because that's a particularly interesting case, because whereas we see evangelicals very eager to spread the gospel to basically every other part of the world, they're not looking necessarily to evangelize in Israel. They have a specific set of principles around that. Their relationship with Israel is much more complex. There has been a lot of historical writing and more recent popular writing that frames evangelical interest in Israel sort of purely in prophetic terms, that they see this desire to, make sure that all of the Jews go back to the homeland so that this, you know, the apocalypse can come. And there's some really fantastic recent work that has come out that has added a considerable amount of nuance to that certainly some of those prophetic beliefs are there, but there's actually a much larger political project and collaboration between evangelicals and the leaders in Israel that is not fully to do with prophecy, but has some sort of broader connections that figure into you know, sets of religious beliefs about the different religious missions of these groups. Evangelicals are, of course, U.S. evangelicals are, of course, very interested in defending Israel. They do seem to see themselves as having a special partnership there. That is interesting, particularly because there are Palestinian Christians who are facing persecution and difficult situations. So it becomes a kind of tricky deal. If I could, if it's okay, if I could recommend a recent book from a colleague of mine, Dan Hummel wrote a book called Covenant Brothers, which is about evangelical engagement in Israel. And it really, I think, provides a lot more context and nuance than many popular authors have written on this topic. And he actually went to Israel. He did research there, historical research in the language. So he's really adding a lot to our understanding about the political project and the connections between these groups, beyond just ideas about the second coming.
Yeah. Okay. So this is, I mean, this might be a little bit of a hard question, but do you think that the Biden administration will move the U.S. embassy from Jerusalem back to Tel Aviv?
That is such an interesting question, because that was a very, very controversial move when the Trump administration moved it. And of course, it does not seem, you know, most Democrats share broadly supportive views of Israel. I'm not sure we're going to see a huge shift there, but yet I will be curious if they move it back, or if because it's moved, we're just, it's sort of a fait accompli and they're not going to go through the trouble. But symbolically, that was a huge deal. It would be, I think, a big symbol if they moved it back. I'm not sure that Biden would necessarily want to, you know, rile up everybody over moving it back again. It seems just so fraught. But that's a great question. I'll be very curious as a historian to see what happens around
Me
that.
Too. Do you have any ideas of what might be the impact if that were to happen?
I wonder, my sense is one of the challenges, of course, that Biden will face is that, well, we don't know exactly what will happen in terms of the balance of the Senate, but if the Senate is majority Republican and he moves it back, there is a question of whether there would be, whether it would be worth the kind of political capital that that would spend to make that change. So I'm wondering if he would prioritize other less symbolic goals that he wanted to pursue and just sort of, well, it's done, I guess we'll just leave it. I'm not sure. It may be slightly different with a Democratic majority in the Senate, but I'm not sure. There is a tremendous amount of support for Israel that is very bipartisan.
We have another question for you here in the chat from the audience. Is the United States evangelical religiosity a relevant factor in how other states, both allies and adversaries, perceive the U.S.? Might it affect their behavior and policies?
I think it's such a good question. I do think this matters, right? Because evangelicals occupy such a pronounced and visible and vocal, even though they're a minority in terms of, like, you know, broad religious, we have a very pluralistic religious landscape in the United States, and they are not the majority, but they have come to kind of represent American Christianity in a way. And I do think that our allies and adversaries are watching that, potentially with some, you know, bemusement or confusion as to why they occupy this particular role. But the reality is that they have been incredibly influential politically for a very long time. It has ebbed and flowed in which areas they're most influential on, but it's very clear over the past 4 years that they have gotten a lot more of their agenda put in place than they had with earlier presidents, certainly. They were a very useful voting bloc for Reagan and for others, but the extent to which President Reagan put in place the policies they wanted to see was much more limited than what we saw during the Trump administration. So I do think adversaries and allies are looking to see, well, what roles do these folks have? Are they in these high levels of government as they were, or will they be as we move forward? What will be interesting to see, I think, will be during the Biden administration, there has been, over the past few years, I think, a resurgence of the religious left, something we don't talk about as much because there's such a focus on the religious right. It will be very interesting to see if the Biden administration can capitalize on some of the enthusiasm around the religious left and see if those groups can have a stronger influence on politics in the years coming.
Well, that would be really interesting to see. Thank you, Professor. Okay, Professor Steele, I have a couple of questions for you. And this might be a little tainted by the fact that I am in your class, but I remember we talked a little bit about, you know, the U.S., their priority is the spread of democracy, and that has been just a part of U.S. culture for so long. It's sort of part of our identity. Do you think as of late that this is still a priority?
No.
Good.
No. So, I mean, just to follow up on, I mean, I don't think it, and there's different debates on how much it really was a priority. I think we can definitely look at particular periods of time, that little windows of time when it definitely was a priority as opposed to what preceded it. So the 1990s are usually, I think, pretty much universally recognized as a period of time when democracy promotion, free of the shackles or the bipolar structure of the Cold War, it was an opportunity that, whether you call it a peace dividend or whatever it was, that the Clinton administration, and especially Tony Lake, Anthony Lake, his national security advisor, they constructed a national strategy that was about, as they called it, engagement and enlargement. So actually creating and fostering as much democracy, building a democracy promotion as possible in a variety of ways, both bilaterally and then also multilaterally through institutions and economically as well in terms of providing some support. But then, you know, any sort of democratic wave that we've ever seen historically in international relations always has a little bit of a receding sort of backsliding is what comparative politics scholars call it and historians call it. And I think you've seen that a little bit over the last 10 to 15 years, that it's not just that you're no longer necessarily seeing as much democratization within countries that were formerly authoritarian or non-democratic, but even in the existing democracies in some different parts of the world, you're seeing a little bit of movement back towards, if not necessarily authoritarian regimes, less democratic, free and fair institutions, like at least some were hoping would be around when a lot of these places were democratizing in the 1990s. And so you see that in Central and Eastern Europe a little bit, some concerns there, some concerns in certain parts of Central and South America. And then there are some that even argue here in the United States that, you know, we're losing some of our democratic institutions, not necessarily losing them all the way, but they're not quite as effective and robust as they used to be. So I think that just generally means or translates to some degree to a kind of conclusion that if democracy promotion is something that is going to be a goal for the United States, it's probably going to take a back seat to some of the more urgent issues that we've already talked about regarding climate change. I think immigration is going to be something that is still going to be a prevalent issue for the United States to be focused on, and in relation to Europe and U.S. allies, and then of course the COVID pandemic.
Great. So you mentioned it was your fourth point that we need to prioritize the good of the American people. Can we expect to see those changes? And especially with what you just mentioned, that the moving forward, we're going to see more focus on environment, on the environment and things like that. Do you think that we can see these changes with the Biden administration as a reflection of him desiring the good of the American people or not?
I'm not even sure, sort of a chicken and egg issue of whether it's him and his, you know, sort of seeing the goodwill of the American people, or the American people are waiting for someone or something or some change to be receptive to their needs and their well-being needs. And I'm not talking about, like, you know, overarching restructuring of society, but just basic needs like, you know, distribution of a vaccine and collective efforts that at least reduce the transmission if it can't be eliminated in between now and then. And so, I actually think there's a strong reservoir of American society that actually can't just be collapsed into one party or another, that kind of wants the well-being of the American people to be a focus. I think some of it may have even been some folks that at least in 2016 voted for President Trump and his America First message. I mean, that's an ambiguous message for at least, you know, lay persons. We can obviously put it in an historical context as folks that have studied U.S. foreign policy for a long time and American history. But you know, putting America First might might also just entail, well, let's focus on taking care of some of the problems that the United States is facing here, stabilizing society a little bit before you start turning your attention back to the world. And so there can be different kind of cross-cutting, but potentially overlapping groups that are out there that are ready for that. And I think President Biden, President-elect Biden, and then eventually President Biden is going to do as much as he can to speak to those multiple groups. I mean, it's been one constant theme in his transitional message that he is a president for all Americans rather than just blue or red state Americans. And that sounds a little bit hokey and corny. And that's kind of the politically correct thing that he needs to say. But you also need that kind of message if you can hope to generate the kind of collective effort that you absolutely need to confront in the immediate term, the COVID pandemic. And I think in the shorter, but also medium term, you know, issues like climate change, which are no longer like in the future anymore. Temporally, they're with us right now, and they're here in the United States right now. And that's going to require not just a broad effort in the United States, but a cooperative, collaborative effort internationally. And so I think that those are the challenges, but I think that those will at least be the attempts in the initial, you know, months and perhaps years of Biden's administration to focus on.
That was Brent Steele, professor and chair of the University of Utah's Political Science Department. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. Once more, here is your moderator, Ann Lopez.
Okay, so the next questions are really for anyone. They're focusing a little bit on current events that are happening. Lately, we've been hearing a lot about threats to national security and a lot of comparisons to 2020's transition of power to 2000 and 9/11 as a consequence. Do you think this is something that we should be concerned about?
I'll let Dr. Miser jump in there.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, we didn't know during the 2000 transition that there was this threat, really. And so as of right now, we don't know. And I think that what we do know for sure is that, and I think, you know, Biden's team has said this, and I think this is accurate, that the lack of coordination right now and in the next few weeks is hampering the new administration's ability to start off their administration really taking strong action on the pandemic and distributing the vaccines. And that's, I think, a couple of years from now, we'll look back and say, oh, wow, that really did have an impact, that slow transition caused problems with coordinating policy on the coronavirus pandemic and the vaccines. I think that's what I would look at, you know, primarily.
I would also point to some of the very recent changes that we've seen at the heads of key agencies, the security agencies, right? Firing officials, putting new people in who are loyalists at the last minute. The announcement of a troop drawdown, a premature troop drawdown in Afghanistan, right? We don't know what's going to come of those. And we can certainly discuss the desirability of sort of ending some of these wars, right? But we don't know the extent to which those seemingly off the cuff decisions, the discussions that were happening around potentially going into a conflict with Iran, right? These are all potentially destabilizing moves by an outgoing lame duck administration that could have profound implications for national security, especially since, as Dr. Miser said, there isn't very much coordination between the incoming administration, right? They're blocking their ability to get access to transition funds and those briefings.
And I'll just jump in as well, and echoing what Professor Turek just said, that, you know, and Anne, you've probably heard me talk too much about this in our U.S. foreign policy class this semester, but, you know, the execution of U.S. foreign policy depends not just on one person coming in, but or even just their cabinet, but all of these different bureaucratic units kind of working on their own and developing their own standard operating procedures, and then, you know, coordinating across the different units to get them to all move in the direction of, as Dr. Miser has studied quite a bit, strategy and or the sort of grand strategy or national interest of the United States. That takes a lot. And if you're having all of this turnover, you always have quite a bit of turnover, but if you have a lot of turnover, but you have to wait to be able to experience that turnover until the very last minute, that might have some particular effects. The other thing that I wanted to mention regarding, you know, especially like 9/11, looking back to 20 years ago, is just something on the issue of terrorism. And this is something I brought up to my students and something that I've thought about as well. And that is, you know, and this is kind of like a downer way to look at it, but I am really wondering if after the United States has dealt with, you know, a pandemic that's killed 250,000 people. And even before that, I brought this up with my students, you know, long before the pandemic happened, but, you know, the daily sort of drumbeat of mass shootings that we've just grown numb to, would a terrorist attack, even if we call it terrorism, we don't call these other things terrorism, would it have the same impact? Would it generate the same amount of terror and anxiety that terrorist attacks did in the past? I think there's a political incentive for political leaders to look at it and categorize it in a different way, but I'm not exactly sure that the American people make that distinction. Now, that, you know, the downside to it is that then we're just numb all over to some of the death and misery that we're dealing with, regardless of the direction that it's coming from. And yet, I still do wonder if the impact of terrorism can be as marked now as it definitely was during the spectacular event of 9/11. I mean, spectacular in terms of a spectacle, not in terms of it being a good thing. It was a horrible, tragic, awful thing. But I do wonder about whether that impact would be as pronounced nowadays.
That brought up an interesting question. It may sound unrelated, but I was just wondering if you're all, you know, very familiar with history, foreign policy. Are there any historical moments in time where you feel that we've been in a similar situation, or are these just completely unprecedented times in regards to foreign policy?
Both of these two are way more steeped in history than I am, so I'm going to defer to both of them.
Yeah, I mean, this is the question that a lot of historians have been getting for the past 4 years. Is this unprecedented? Because in so many ways, it does feel unprecedented. History, we love to say, well, history repeats itself. There are aspects of it that seem similar, that as I think Mark Twain said, that rhyme, right? That are useful to look at. I don't think we can assume it's going to be the same in any particular moment. But that said, there are moments, right? We can think back to the 1918 flu pandemic for some insight into the current pandemic that we're dealing with and the ways in which that shaped the ability of world leaders to come together and resolve and deal with the kind of crisis of the war that they were fighting. So I think we could look for historical connections there. It's not going to be exactly the same. The context is in every way different, but some lessons there. We've certainly had, we've had leaders before who, maybe not to the extent of the present, but who behaved in sort of, I guess, corrupt ways, who were impeached and so on and so forth. We can draw some connections there. There are a lot of aspects about the present moment that are very different though. So I think we do want to remember that although we can look to the past for useful lessons and ideas, the past is in many ways quite different from where we are at this moment. So we want to be, I think, just circumspect about how much we can look to the past and say, aha, it's going to be like this. We actually don't know. There's so much contingency in any given moment.
That's great. Thank you. Okay, so this is a little broadening. You, a couple of you kind of already touched on it, but what do you see as the future of U.S. hegemony?
I think that, so Biden, if he's anything, he's very old school. You know, he's been in politics for 40 years or more, and in a sense, that's good. I think that will reassure some people, but I think he'll probably kind of move in the perspective of trying to reinvigorate American leadership, kind of from an American exceptionalist point of view of we're the indispensable nation, and try and recapture that moment, which I think is sort of gone. And so I think that what, you know, the shape of American hegemony moving forward is more like, you know, the first among equals, or maybe not even so much that, is the coordinator of an alliance system, which is more towards what I think they should head towards. And I think, you know, I don't think that's what Biden will do. I think he will try and sort of reinvigorate this indispensable nation idea. And I think that it won't really gain much traction.
Anyone else want to comment on that?
Yeah, I'll just mention briefly. I mean, I think it's an interesting question. It kind of goes back to the basis of my remarks, right? I mean, I think it is important for the United States, at least some in the United States, to see itself as the if not necessarily the indispensable nation, at least the hegemon on top. And there's a lot of different ways that a hegemon can handle being a hegemon. They can withdraw, but still be able to project military power, like I think the Trump administration has done. And then there can be the ways that Dr. Meiser just mentioned it, that I think he's probably right, that Biden's administration is going to put into play. I mean, the only thing, I'm not really good at predictions. The only thing I will say is that if the United States tends to do a little bit more of a collaborative approach, I think there are ways in which that will be good for the world, and it definitely will be good for the United States. And in some ways, maintain the United States, or at least consolidate its power over the long term, than if it does any of the two approaches that have been really obsessed with U.S. hegemony over the last 20 years, which is sort of the Jacksonian approach. We're at the top of the hierarchy. We need to show everybody our might. And then the neoconservative approach, which is let's go in and try to create a bunch of democracies by force and the threat of force. And they'll be so inspired that everybody will bandwagon with us. You know, to some degree, that obsession with hegemony had, in my view, actually led to the decline of U.S. relative power vis-a-vis some of the other great powers who sat back and let the United States sort of trip over itself, so to speak. So that's. That's just a comment I wanted to throw out there to that, I think, really provocative question.
Great. Thank you. That was wonderful. Thank you for all of your thoughts. I just want to ask, are there any closing thoughts, any words of comfort or caution that you would prescribe, anything to like sum this conversation up?
I mean, we have students out there. So two things that I just want to throw in there to plug. First off, read both of these scholars' books, Jeff Meiser's book on power and restraint, and Lauren's book that she already mentioned on spreading the good news, her book that just came out this year. Both are in paperback, by the way, so a lot cheaper than you would normally find, and very good reads. But the only other thing I wanted to say is that, you know, the future of U.S. foreign policy doesn't just rest with, you know, old folks like me and older folks like Biden or Trump. Or them, it rests with all of the students that are out there. And one of the things, as a political scientist and somebody that's interested in history, that I think the pandemic has revealed is that we have a lot of good scientists out there. We have a lot of good epidemiologists that are developing all kinds of approaches to the pandemic. But if we're not considering the political and historical implications of public health, we're not going to be able to implement any of the suggestions and advice and prescriptions that, you know, the scientists are giving us. And so giving people a well-rounded college education that focuses on humanities and social sciences, history, along with public health is and or climate change and or whatever else is kind of the way in which the future of U.S. foreign policy, I think, can maybe have some optimistic scenarios going forward. So I just wanted to throw that in there and plug that we need to have more political science and history degrees out there.
I love it.
I so agree. If I could just echo what Dr. Steele said, if there's one thing that my research has shown, it's that domestic interest groups, so students out there who are passionate about particular policies, who care about the direction of the government, direction of U.S. foreign policy, those interest groups can have a really significant influence on U.S. foreign policy making. It seems so far away, right? It seems like these are decisions that are only made by presidents and by people in Congress. But individual Americans' voices matter, right? They can, with enough coordination and activism, make a discernible difference in the direction of U.S. foreign policy. So you shouldn't feel powerless about the direction of U.S. foreign relations. You should feel ready to get engaged, ready to mobilize on behalf of the values that you would like to promote and get out there and find like-minded people to advocate with.
That's great. Professor Meiser?
Yeah, I think that, you know, drawing on both of the comments that to a large degree, American foreign policy and how the U.S. is seen in the world is a reflection of our domestic politics. And to the degree that we are seen to be riven by, you know, political polarization and racial conflict and all these divisions, I think that that diminishes the United States. And so I think that the, to the degree we can overcome those or work towards progress domestically, that will, you know, deepen and strengthen our soft power abroad. And I mean, Biden will get a quick bump in soft power. Like you'll have, like the U.S. is polling very low internationally right now in terms of the opinion that people have of the United States under Trump was very low. That will go, it'll double in some places, you know, basically overnight when Biden takes office. But to make that durable, we have to be, have an attractive culture. We have to have attractive institutions. People have to look to the United States and the principles of the Americans and find them attractive to make that a durable kind of capacity for the United States. And so I think you, you mentioned Vice President Harris, that helps symbolically to have, you know, a diverse leadership in the United States. I think that helps a lot internationally, but it has to be deeper than that. And so I would think that that's a really important issue to also consider. And at Dr. Twerk, that is something that we can affect ourselves. So I think that's very important.
We're wrapping things up there. If you'd like to hear the full form, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your producer and host of this program. Thanks for listening.